The first panel today is on race, the war on drugs, and effective legal advocacy. It's an issue that touches me personally. I have a, well, my husband's Peruvian. We got married about a year ago, and I'll tell you, boy, your risk factors really change when you're with someone of color. I, of course, you know, grew up in the Midwest. Even though I've been arrested for cannabis a bunch of times, it's all been pretty mellow. But I'll tell you what, now we get followed through town by the police behind us, and Miguel's driving the car, and we're pulled over. And thank God my attorney, Bill Panzer, has come to our rescue again and again and again. Every time I get a phone call from Miguel, though, I'm like, answer the phone. Is it going to be the cops behind him again? Because that's happened to us numerous times. Miguel's on the side of the road, and I'm just going, Jesus, this is just pitiful. So it's a sad state, I think, when it comes to race, and especially in the war on drugs. We have a great panel. We have Norm Stamper, former chief of police of Seattle. We're excited about that. Also a cop for like 30 years, I guess. Yeah. We have Billy Murphy, attorney from Baltimore, whose birthday it is today, by the way. Yes. And we have Tony Serra, who is going to be arriving to speak also. It's a long panel. We have almost an hour and a half for the panel, so I think these guys will each speak for about 15 minutes. I'll turn things over to Norm Stamper to sort of introduce his panel more. Norm, like I said, he was the chief of police from 1994 to 2000 in Seattle. We love Seattle. Thank you. You set the tone for what was to come, so we appreciate that greatly. Before that, he was a member of the police force for, I think, 26 years? 28 years. Let's see. Joined LEAP, which is a great organization, as you know, created for law enforcement officials who are just tired of the drug war and need a place to have their voice heard and to band together, you know, to help each other and to protect each other. And most importantly, he's an author now, so he's getting his word out to a lot of people. And this is his book. It's called Breaking Rank, a Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. So with no further ado, here is Norm Stamper.
Thanks very much, Debbie, and thank you for that warm welcome. At probably 22 years of age and about a year and a half into my 34-year police career, I got a call to a house in Kensington in San Diego. Nice house, very spendy house. And like smart cops everywhere, I approached the building cautiously. When I arrived, I parked maybe half a block down the street, took the keys off my belt ring and put them in my pocket so they wouldn't be jangling when I walked up to the door. I got up to the porch to the tune of a very loud and quite cool rock and roll tune. I don't remember now what it was. And the characteristic odor of a green vegetable matter being burned. Not dissimilar from the odors I've been picking up the last three or four days here at the Holiday Inn. In those days, that characteristic odor and my expertise as a rookie police officer with no special training justified the action that I was about to take. It established probable cause. In those days, the mere possession of marijuana was a felony. And so I stood at the door, off to the side of the door. You don't want to hear this, Judge. Stood off to the side of the door, listened very carefully, and kicked the door in. And simultaneously, I'm almost certain, announced San Diego Police. I darted inside to the sound of a toilet flushing. And made my way to one of the back rooms where I found a 19-year-old kid who was in the possession of what was left of his stash. This happened to be his parents' home. This home now had a solid core door resting atop the beautiful hardwood floors of their home. He had enough seeds and stems to justify the possession arrest, so I gathered that up, hooked him up, hands behind his back, marched him out to my police car, put him in the car, and drove him to jail. this night was to become my first epiphany on the war of drugs, which at that time had not yet been declared, but make no mistake, was still being waged. On the way to jail, sitting in the back seat of the car, this kid, I was, you know, 3 years his senior, is saying, "Oh, wow, look at this cage." He's talking about the cage between the front and back seat, you know. And he's asking me if I got any Cheetos or Fritos, and, you know. And I'm kind of giggling to myself. And then I'm thinking, what the hell am I doing? What am I doing? I kicked not this kid's door down, but his parents' door down. I darted into this house. However kind and gentle I thought the arrest might be, I put myself in his shoes. If he had been sober enough to appreciate what was going on, I'm sure he would have been absolutely terrorized. I violated, I'm convinced, the human rights, if not the civil liberties, of a fellow citizen. And to what end? What good did I accomplish that night? I know now how much harm I accomplished that night, but what good did I accomplish for him, his family, his community, our society, sworn to uphold the law, to protect and to serve? I could have been in somebody's living room stopping a man from beating his wife or his children. I could have been going after a daytime residential burglary series suspect who was operating in my area at that time. I could have gone after somebody who stuck a gun in the face of a proprietor of a mom-and-pop grocery store. I could have done any number of things that would actually have contributed to the health and safety and well-being of the community that I had been hired to serve. But instead, I did what I just described. That was my first epiphany. In the following months and years, I found myself engaged in countless arguments with my peers. The drug enforcement effort was, in fact, supported by the federal government prior to 1970, but when, in fact, Nixon declared war on drugs in 1970 and the clock started ticking and the money started pouring in to local jurisdictions, we really stepped it up many, many notches. And it was during those early days that I found myself in countless conversations about what we were achieving, what we were accomplishing, and what harm we were doing. And I was particularly concerned that we weren't getting help for people who really needed it. I'm talking now about heroin addicts, and later when PCP came along and when individuals found themselves in grievous trouble, that we had absolutely no services to provide for them. So I found myself early on engaged in that kind of a dialogue. As I got promoted through the ranks, and of course I had other passions in police work, I've already alluded to one, domestic violence. It was my number one priority as a deputy chief and an assistant chief in San Diego and as the police chief in Seattle, ending violence on the home on the assumption that violence in the home and violence between people who purport to love one another is a precursor to all other forms of violence. I was interested. Thank you. I was interested in measures of accountability and a firm believer in authentic community policing, which is to say, authentic partnerships between the community and the police in everything, in policy making, in program development, in crisis management, and foremost, in citizen oversight of police practices. I was interested, thank you, in the demilitarization of American policing. If you want to know why cops have it in for you and for so many other drug users and drug reformers, take a look, please, at the way policing is organized. That structure gives rise to the culture of policing, and it is that culture that produces the events with depressing predictability and with all of the attendant harm. We have got to look at reorganizing policing. That's a topic for another time, another place, but one that it is that is critical to getting police support for ending the war on drugs. I think it's also critical to point out that I am a legalizer. I use the L word proudly. Thank you. A position that I've come to based on a long-held belief, but also innumerable years of experience with prohibition and the realization that it doesn't work, that it never has, never will, because it can't work. And so when Richard Nixon declared war on drugs and ushered in a new version of prohibition in this country, officially recognized and funded to an extraordinary degree, we found police officers from the DEA to the state and local agencies signing on and investing in this war on drugs, which begins to suggest one of the major problems in helping us turn it around. I'm convinced that the legalization of drugs, that the end to prohibition, predicated on two basic premises, will create vastly improved community health and safety for every one of us in this country. Why? Because if we're able somehow to frame drug use as a civil liberty, if I am able to say to you, just as you would be free to say to me, this is my body. What I choose to put in this body is my business, no one else's, least of all my government's business. How I behave under the influence of whatever I put in this body could very well become the business of government, the duty of government. If I drive impaired by any drug, including the most pernicious of all, alcohol, my drug of choice, if I furnish to a kid, if I steal from you to finance my habit or my addiction, government does have a responsibility to step in, preferably to prevent that behavior, but failing that, to enforce criminal sanctions for those who commit criminal violations. Imagine if the police were arresting car prowlers and burglars and robbers and domestic violence offenders and rapists and others engaged in sexual assault. Imagine if police were focused on predatory street crime and not narcotics or drug use. Imagine the support that my institution would get from people throughout this country if, in fact, the police were to say the abuse of drugs, addiction to drugs, harm caused to the individual, to family, to community by drugs is a medical problem. And therefore, a public health policy issue. Cops focused on real crime, community, including police officers, partnered up to treat drug abuse and drug addiction and harms caused under the influence of drugs as a medical problem, even as the police enforce appropriate laws. That's my dream. That's my vision. It's a vision that is shared by LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. If you've not seen the back of my shirt, I think I'll make a visual aid of it. No. Thank you. No, as I was telling Billy, I live in a cabin on an island 10 feet away from my writing studio, and I couldn't be happier there. I enjoy this very much. I don't like the in-between stuff. I don't like trying to travel from my island by ferry, especially in tourist season, to get where I need to get, which is almost always SeaTac, and then off typically with a delayed flight to some other spot to give a talk. I enjoy the talks very much, and I'll always be committed to this work. But it does bring me to a critically important issue, and that is, how do legalizers like me converse with marijuana reformers like you? Some of us share the same philosophy, the same commitment, the same belief. Many in this room, I have to assume, do not. In my travels, especially in the last 6 months, I've heard from people who are deeply committed to the commercialization, the industrialization of hemp, who don't want to hear a word about recreational or social or personal use of marijuana, because they're afraid that that will affect the effort, fundamentally environmental effort, to gain the full commercialization, the industrialization of this wonderful alternative to so many harmful products. And they're afraid that smoking marijuana, for example, will retard progress in that effort. I have talked to medical marijuana users who say, please don't use the word recreational or social or personal, because that will harm our efforts to achieve what we desperately need. I've talked to people who support the decriminalization but not the legalization of marijuana, whatever their intention, simply to achieve a little peace of mind, the ability to live a little bit more freely, but who perhaps are afraid that the legalization of marijuana is an idea whose time has not come. They're clearly wrong about that. But they believe it, they feel it, and therefore, I think, need to be respected. I have talked to legalizers of marijuana who say, if you go one step further and you put heroin or cocaine or crystal meth or shrooms or LSD in that next sentence, we part company, because you're going to ruin it for those of us who are deeply committed to marijuana law reform and who want to see marijuana legalized. Please help me understand how all of us together, given the example that Ethan cited for us yesterday, can create a tent large enough for those who love drugs, those who hate drugs, and those who don't give a damn about drugs, but care about civil liberties and the Constitution of this country. How do we create a tent large enough to build the kinds of numbers and sheer strength associated with numbers and tipping points that will allow us to achieve the kinds of reform that I think we all want? What do we all have in common? We see the damning, the exhaustive, the outrageously expensive and immoral costs of the war on drugs. We all see, feel, and experience that. That's what we have in common. The last thing I want to do is hurt normal, especially since I've become a member of its advisory board. Thank you. I am a bit schizophrenic because I'm also an advisory board member for LEAP, which again is dedicated to ending prohibition. When I decided to join LEAP, I called my dear friend and colleague Ethan and asked, is this going to be a problem for you? I loved his response, which was no. and with the kind of reasoning and eloquence that you would associate with his response. When Rick Steves asked me to join Normal's advisory board, because I had asked him to join Leap's advisory board, I called Jack Cole, the executive director, 26-year veteran of the New Jersey State Police, 14 years as an undercover narc. I don't mean somebody who superficially flitted in and out of buy-bust hand-to-hand negotiations on the street. This is a guy who became an undercover narc, deep cover, for 14 years. His talk about the shame that he feels about those 14 years of experience is well worth listening to. My question of him is, Normal wants me to join their advisory board. Is that going to be a problem for you? I also spoke by email to Alan, asking if that would be a problem for him. What is this kind of nonsense? We all want to see an end to the war on drugs. The debate that Ethan talked about between and among us is critical to tactics, to strategy, to how we handle ourselves, our statements to the media, and the like. And to that end, I would just challenge you and me and all others involved in drug policy reform to find a way to expand that tent as large as we possibly can and to capitalize on the numbers of people who are sick of the war on drugs. I'd like to now make a transitional statement and turn it over to Billy of Baltimore, as he was described to me, who has an incredible career, and I hope you'll talk about that and maybe some of the people you've defended, simply because I am just intensely curious to hear that story. The war on drugs is not a war on drugs at all. It is a war on people. Disproportionately, those people are young. Disproportionately, those people are poor. And disproportionately, those people are of color. Racism in the war on drugs is incredibly powerful and insidious. And it seems to me that one of the best ways we can honor those decent police officers who are hardworking, compassionate, really understand and know and perhaps even agree with many of the philosophies and positions that I've articulated this morning, are still forced into a situation that makes it very hard for them not to be accused of racism. I will be the first to tell you that racism is alive and well in American police forces. There is not a single police department in this country, perhaps shy of one that has two or three members, and even then I'd have my doubts, that is not afflicted by racism. And I'm talking now about personal, not structural, not institutional racism. But what about those good cops who are working, let's say, in inner city neighborhoods, in communities of color, who get a call from a mom who's scared to death that the drug dealing on the street corner is going to capture the imagination of her 8-year-old or 13-year-old child and calls the cops? You can see the problem that this puts the police. It is extremely important that we end the war on drugs to help end a form of racism that is indeed structural and institutional and driven by the war on drugs, even as we fight individual racism within police officers.